Well, it wasn't easy. I had to agree to sneak a piece of quartz onto the podium today. She says the electromagnetic field from the crystal will combine with Andy's electrical field to erase negativity and recharge energy stores. Oh, God, Dave, no! He squared his shoulders, and Sartre rippled defiantly on his chest. She's here, isn't she? And look. He held up a sliver of rose quartz that glittered benignly in the sunlight. You can put these things in water, you know. Eve says they charge up the people drinking it and bring them into harmony with their environment. Actually, we had quite a nice talk about it. Why don't you make Roma a nice cup of water on the rocks? I pointed to the far end of the stage where Andy's mother Roma was sitting stiffly, as far away as she could get from her daughter-in-law. She looks like she could use some harmonizing. Actually, what we probably need is a slab of quartz dropped in the water supply for the whole city. Take care of all of our problems. Beside me, Howard gazed innocently in the direction of the ball diamonds. Dave snapped the clip on his clipboard. You don't have to be such a bitch, Joe. In fact, if you could manage to let up a little, I could tell you about our real triumph. He smoothed the crease of his shorts and looked at me. Rick Spencer's here today. I was impressed. What's he doing here? I know this is big stuff for us, but it's penny ante for the networks. Why would those guys at CVT send their top political commentator to cover a little picnic on the prairies? I don't know, said Dave, but I'm ecstatic. There are a lot of nice visuals here today. All the little kids guessing how many jelly beans are in the jar, and the old geezers throwing horseshoes and reminiscing. How many points do you think all this Heartland charm will be worth in the polls, Joe? You'll have to ask Howard. He's the expert. But Howard was heading behind the stage, where the major players, as they like to think of themselves, were talking politics and drinking warm beer out of plastic cups. It didn't matter. We couldn't have heard Howard anyway because Craig Evanson had finished. Andy was walking across the stage to the podium, and the crowd was on its feet. They had waited all afternoon for this, the moment when Andy would stand before them. Now he was here, and they were wild, clapping their hands together in a ragged attempt at rhythm and calling his name again and again. Andy, Andy, Andy. Two distinct syllables, regular as heartbeats until throats grew hoarse and the beat became thready. We could see Andy clearly now. He was wearing an open-necked shirt the color of the sky, and when he saw Dave and me, he grinned and waved his baseball cap in the air. The crowd cheered as if he had turned stone to gold. Finally, Andy raised his hands to quiet them. Then he turned toward Dave and me and made a drinking gesture. Water, I said. Taken care of, said Dave. And he ran behind the stage and came back carrying a tray with a glass and a black thermal pitcher. When he went by me, he stopped and pointed to a little hand-lettered sign he taped onto the side of the thermos. For the use of Andy Boychuk only. All others drink this and die. I laughed. So much for the brotherhood of the common man. Dave passed the tray to the woman who was acting as MC for the entertainment. She was a big woman, wearing a flower-printed dress. I remember thinking all afternoon that she must have been suffering from the heat. She handed Andy the tray with a pretty little flourish, and he took it with a gallant gesture. I moved to the side of the stage. There was a patch of shade there, and it gave me a clear view of Andy and of the crowd. They were arranging themselves for the speech, trying to find a cool spot on their beach towels, pouring watery, tepid drinks out of thermoses, slipping kids a couple of dollars for the amusement booths that had been set up. Afterward, even the police were astounded at how few people had any real memory of what they saw in those last moments. But I saw, and I remembered. Andy filled his glass from the thermos, drank the water, all of it, then opened the blue leather folder that contained the speech I'd written for him. It was a sequence I'd watched 100 times. But this time, instead of sliding his thumbs to the top of the podium, leaning toward the audience and beginning to speak, he turned to look at Dave and me. He was still smiling, but then something dark and private flickered across his face. He looked perplexed and sad, the way he did when someone asked him a question that revealed real ugliness. Then he turned toward the back of the stage and collapsed. From the time he turned until the time he fell was, I am sure, less than 5 seconds. It seemed like a lifetime. As I looked at the empty podium, I knew it was all over. I hugged the portfolio to me. In it was the last speech I would ever write for Andy Boychuk. The solid line of family and friends shattered into dazed groups. Eve Boychuk, Andy's wife, moved from her chair to the portable staircase. She was blocking the stairs, trying to keep the ambulance attendants from taking her husband away. The August sun was getting low in the sky, and as she stood blocking the stairway, Eve was backlit with golden light. It was a striking picture. She wore a short sundress made of unbleached cotton, and she seemed to be all brown limbs. Powerful athlete's shoulders, strong arms, long, taut-muscled legs. She looked strong and invulnerable. But her face was dead with disbelief, and her eyes were terrible, vacant and unseeing. The sirens were getting closer. Dave Micklejohn came up behind Eve, moved her from the staircase, and started giving directions to the ambulance attendants. Bring him over to the side of the stage, he said. Then he turned to me. Come on, Joe. Let's jump down over here and they can lower Andy to us. And that's what we did. When she saw what we were doing, Eve came over and grabbed Dave's hand and we all jumped down together. We must have looked like actors from the theater of the absurd, but it was right that we were the ones who took Andy from the stage that last time. They hadn't brought the ambulance up to the stage. There were so many people on the grounds, and I guess someone had told them there wasn't any hurry. We wouldn't let the ambulance people take over. They tried, but Dave, who was usually the most courteous of men, snarled at them to get away. As we began carrying Andy toward the ambulance, a woman dressed in blue came over, wordlessly took one corner of the stretcher from Dave, and walked along with us. I had noticed her earlier because she was a genuine beauty. She was, I think, close to 60, but auburn-haired still, and she had the freckled skin of the natural redhead. As one of the attendants slid Andy's body into the ambulance, she reached her hand out toward the open doors in a gesture so poignant that Dennis Whitaker from our city paper, The Sun Examiner, took a picture of her that the paper used on their front page the next day. We should have counted our lucky stars when we opened the paper and saw that heart-stopping picture. It could have been worse. Seconds after that photo was taken, the nightmare of that afternoon turned another corner. Eve Boychuk had climbed into the ambulance before the attendants put Andy's body in. She was hunched over, sitting on one of the little jump seats ambulances have so family members can go along to the hospital with their loved ones. The ambulance had begun to pull away when a small dark figure broke through the crowd and ran after it. She was shouting, but in a language I couldn't understand. It was Andy's mother, Roma Boychuk. 83 years old, brought from her neat little home in the west of Saskatoon to watch her son's triumph, and we had forgotten about her. She had lived in Canada for 70 years, but she was still uneasy with English. Ukrainian was the language of her heart, and it was in Ukrainian she was crying out as she tried to stop the ambulance that was carrying her son away. The scene was like something out of a silent movie. The round little figure in black running across the field, dust swirling around her heavy legs as the sun fell in the sky and the ambulance sped away. But the movie wasn't silent, and you didn't have to know Ukrainian to hear the anguish in her voice. I didn't recognize the man who ran after her. He was tall and very thin. He looked like the singer James Taylor. The auburn-haired woman and I stood and watched as he reached Roma and closed her small body in his arms for a few moments and then, still holding her, walked across the dusty field toward us. When he came close, we could hear that he was saying to her the soft, repetitive nonsense words you use to soothe a child. She was crying freely now, and her pain hung in the air like vapor. The auburn-haired woman felt it and reached out to Roma. She placed her fingertips under Roma's chin and gently lifted the old woman's face so that Roma could see her. They stood there looking into one another's eyes for perhaps 10 seconds, two women united by grief and pain. Then Roma made a terrible, feral sound, a hissing growl, the sound of a kicked cat, and she leaned closer to the woman and spat in her face. The man grabbed Roma, and I reached for the auburn-haired woman, but she was running across the field toward the parking lot. I started after her, but when I'd run a few steps, I was hit by a sense of futility. What was the point? Andy was dead. And so I just stood there as sirens sliced the air and police cars screamed over the hill. Then someone was holding me. Suddenly, my daughter Mika was behind me. Her arms, suntanned and strong, were around me. "Oh, Mummy." She buried her head in my neck the way she had when she was a little girl.